MarkTheMarkKey.com today.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
We continue amazingly, even though it seems like only 30, 40 minutes have passed. We are in the second hour of the Paracast with David Kaiser. We're taking a quantum leap through time and space. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the Paracast. So looking here at what these hippies discovered, what were you doing, by the way? Parenthetically, what was David Kaiser doing in the 1970s?
Mostly watching Saturday morning cartoons. I was a pretty young kid. So, you know, I joke in the book, I guess in the acknowledgments, I say, my memories of the 70s are hazy, but not because they were clouded, you know, by psychedelics, because I was, you know, like a toddler. So, I was slowly, you know, trying to learn about the world, but in a different way than the folks I write about.
So I guess if you remember the 70s, you're either too young or, had spent too much time in the 60s. An interesting little side note here is Jack Sarfati is going to be at the DARPA-NASA Star Drive Symposium in October, and I believe he's going to be presenting some sort of paper addressing his concept of negative energy-powered starships. So he's still Mr. Outrageous. He's still out there pushing the envelope. So kind of keep your eyes open, listeners, for word on on his paper, and if we can get him on the show, he's agreed to get on, we'll maybe get into that a little bit. The whole concept of negative energy, to me, I guess your average New Ager would cringe, thinking, oh my God, negative energy powering the starship? So,
by the way, is that antimatter, negative energy?
No, it's not. Okay. It's different.
We can't build dilithium crystals.
On my arm?
We can't build dilithium crystals. I'm so sad.
Metamaterials, Andrew says. I'm here with Andrew Pofferman, who is a software engineer for many years at Cisco. He was one of those rare individuals that was actually accepted into Oxford University when he was 16, so he's a bright guy. And he's busy writing down up a couple of questions and comments as he's listening to us do the show here.
We should bring him on for a few minutes.
I'll see if I can twist his arm and get him on here. But
like
he's been working for over 12 years with on the Woodward effect. Are you familiar with that at all, David? The Mach-E and general relativity and Mayor Millis's BPR number one choice.
So I'm familiar with some of the work on Mach's principle and relativity and some efforts to explain the origin of inertia. I'm not familiar with the things you mentioned just now, though.
Yeah, so what's Woodward's first name, Andrew? Yeah, James T. Woodward at Cal State Fullerton. Andrew's been working with him really closely for quite a number of years on it's called frictionless propulsion, I think, propellantless propulsion. So maybe Woodward and Sarfati might compare notes at one time. Well, let's get back to our physics group, and we were talking about Nick Herbert's multi-year attempt, and with Sarfati's help and the physics group's help, to come up with a design for faster-than-light communication, which ultimately was shot down. Even though he did get a paper published, if I remember correctly, it was, as you alluded to, it was sort of proven to not be a workable hypothesis. What were some of the other early experiments that these guys were doing before we had, of course, the famous success of the Tao of Physics and the Dancing Woolly Masters from two of the members of the group? Why don't you kind of give us another sense of what some of the other areas that they were working in?
You know, one device they actually really did build, Nick Herbert built with another friend and colleague, they called a metaphase typewriter. This again was a marvelous example of the kind of playfulness built on some real earnest serious thinking. And it's, you know, it was a delight to learn about. So part of what really intrigued these members of the group was this question of consciousness. That's a lot of what they were after. And one question in particular was whether consciousness could have an effect on sort of steering quantum events. That's to say, and that goes back in some sense, at least inspired by some ideas, speculations by Nobel laureates like Eugene Wigner which again, and John Wheeler, which had not really been getting much play in the mainstream physics world, but these folks really wrestled with it and they picked up on. And the idea was, could human consciousness, or maybe any consciousness, kind of steer, could it alter the underlying probability distribution for seemingly random quantum events? And Wigner had ideas to suggest that maybe consciousness is what he would have said collapses the quantum wave function, or plays some crucial role in quantum measurement. And that was, you know, it's a legitimate thing to be asking about. And these folks were curious about that. And so Nick realized if it's really consciousness and not, say, brain chemistry in a physical fleshy brain, then it needn't be restricted to the person sitting next to you. What if it could be spirits, you know, from the other side and so on? So basically, these guys wired up a pretty cool device in the 1970s for a kind of 1870s, you know, phenomenon to worry about spiritualism or getting using a kind of spirit medium to hear from spirits from beyond. So they did this, and they did it many times, and among my favorite examples, they had a big party on the centennial of the birth of Harry Houdini, famous magician, and they wanted to see if Houdini's spirit could somehow, the consciousness could steer the kind of probabilities for quantum events, in particular if it's, say, like the radioactive decay of a thallium sample. So each decay should be a random event, but with an average half-life. And so the question was, could a consciousness like, say, the spirit of Harry Houdini start, you know, sort of speeding up or slowing down, changing from the average likelihood of given radioactive decay? And if so, could that be used to sort of rat-tat-tat out like a Morse code message? So they hooked this detector, Geiger counter, up to a teletype machine. They got a paper from the National Security Agency on the letter frequencies in the English language, how common is the letter E, how often does it appear with the letter D, and so on. And they wanted to do it really very carefully and scientifically. And they wondered, you know, could, when they hooked up this Geiger counter to the teletype, would they only get random noise, just jumbles of letters, or would there be intelligible messages in there? And they called that the metaphase typewriter. So that's an example of, among many, where these folks were, as Nick, I think, later recalled, it was at the very least a good excuse for a really good party. And there was a way to celebrate Harry Houdini, think hard about quantum theory and consciousness, and have a good time. So they were, you know, I think that captures the spirit of the group. This was not a throwaway. I mean, they were worried about alternative explanations for the measurement problem in quantum theory, which is, like, you know, remains a huge, big deal problem, even for mainstream physicists. And they wanted to sort of highlight just how weird the quantum universe really is in a very playful, very evocative way.
Well, what did Houdini have to say?
opinions differ. So Saul Paul Sirach, whom I mentioned earlier, wrote a really lovely kind of fictionalized account, a short story about the metaphase typewriter. It appeared in this magazine called Spit in the Ocean, which was at the time edited by Ken Casey, the Merry Pranksters. It was in a special issue edited by Timothy Leary. And so in Saul Paul's fictionalized account, they see this string of letters at the back that says basically, and in an infinite time, as if Harry Houdini was too frustrated. This was too slow a device to get his thoughts across. It's like when I try to text on my cell phone, it takes me an hour and a half. So I guess they, in the story, you know, Houdini's spirit was saying, I'd love to chat with you fellows, but this is going to take too long. That was fictionalized. However, some people who were there claim that there was a string of characters that was recognizable in the midst, again, of kind of random noise or a jumble of letters, and that was the letters that would spell out by Jung, B-Y-J-U-N-G, and some claim that was just as a lab tech was walking by with a copy of the portable Jung, you know, in her pocket. So, you know, some of them will say, look, you see. Others will say, you know, monkeys on typewriters will type out Shakespeare. That's just a random fluctuation. But, you know, at the very least, they were going to explore the foundations of quantum theory and, you know, like I say, have a good time.
One question I have here, which is something we can explore as we continue with this episode, and we are going to have to do our break very shortly. The question I have here is, for regular, normal people, what technology did these people develop in the 70s that we could recognize today? I'm not talking necessarily about quantum entanglements, but things that people could buy in the store. Anything?
Well, sure, and one technology was the popular book. I mean, some of these, the best-selling books of that generation, were written by members of that group, like the Tao Physics that I mentioned, like the Dancing Woolly Masters by Gary Zukav. Jack Sarfati and Fred Allen Wolf wrote one with their friend Bob Tobin. They really helped jumpstart the whole genre called Space, Time, and Beyond. And in fact, there were, you know, about a dozen of these books that came out. So that's one way that they were getting the message out literally into the hands of soon to be, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask you more to flesh that out in our next segment with David Kaiser. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Have you been sitting on a few great domain name ideas but haven't locked them in for yourself? Good. Now you can buy them through the number one domain name registrar, Namecheap.com, as voted by the top tech blog Lifehacker. Just like the name says, you can buy domains cheap, as low as $2.99, and every new domain comes with WhoisGuard, our special privacy service, free for the first year. Now that you know, it's time to grab those domain names before someone else does. Namecheap.com. Go now. Namecheap.com.
Fate Magazine provides true reports of the strange and unknown. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, life after death, and much, much more. To receive your free issue of Fate Magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Again, the Congressional Budget Office sounds the alarm. This time warns of Greek-style U.S. debt crises. You heard me right. The GAO is drawing a parallel between the U.S. economy, its debt, and the current Greek economic meltdown. With the debt-to-GDP chart climbing into unfamiliar territory, the growing budget deficit will rise to unsupportable levels. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. The Federal Debt and Risk of Financial Crises document the CBO has published is a must-read for every American. Covering the risk of continued deficit spending coupled with an aging population and the rising interest rates spell economic disaster. It's imperative that you get a copy of this document and study it for yourself. Call me today at 800-686-2237, and I'll send you a free copy. Again, call 800-686-2237 and ask for your copy of the CBO document. Once again, you need to read this government report. Call 800-686-2237.
The American people think they live in a constitutional republic, land of the free, home of the brave. Right.
Just try those lines on the judge when you get a ticket or have to deal with a big bad IRS.
Instead, use escapeharassment.com. Since 1972, our volunteer group of researchers and educators have successfully taught how to escape tickets by law, and it works. Escape Harassment has three different steps to follow, depending on where you are in the ticket process. Learn how to escape tickets, IRS, or court proceedings before you go to court. For free, three-minute pre-recorded information and FAQs, call this toll-free number, 1-877-457-9009. That's 877-457-9009. Or go to escapeharassment.com and see our money back guarantee. That's escapeharassment.com. Remember, escape harassment works.
The food storage industry leader has done it again.
Introducing FDG Clubs and Survival Bucks from the Freeze Dry Guy. For over 39 years, the Freeze Dry Guy has served various government agencies and the private sector with the finest in storable foods and emergency rations. If you've wanted to build emergency food supplies but couldn't afford it,
now you can.
Go to freezedryguy.com, click on products, and look for the Freeze Dry Guy Clubs to pay as you go.
Now you can build food storage without going into debt.
Choose from a payment range of $95 to $450 per month.
Our clubs work with everyone's budget.
Plus, when you join Freeze Dry Guy Clubs, you'll get additional rewards. For example, this month, get 10% back in survival bucks on all purchases in the Freeze Dry Guy product line, plus free shipping within the lower 48 states on any order amount. Hurry, go to freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. That's freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-3663. The Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We want to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news at theparacast.com. And if you want to catch up on past episodes, we have hundreds of shows for you to download direct from theparacast.com. That's theparacast.com. Or check us out on iTunes.
We have David Kaiser, and he's a professor over at MIT. We're talking about those wacky physicist, hippie-type people from the 70s with Gene and Chris and the Paracast. So the other part of the question is, of course, they came out with books, best-selling books. What about consumer electronics, other products that we could buy in the stores? Anything they developed from all this research?
Yeah, none that I know of. The main one, like I said, that I trace in the book is helping to lay the theoretical groundwork for these very very fancy devices today, like quantum encryption. But those are the ones that I know of. I remember most of these members of the group were theoretical physicists. They worked with some laser physicists like Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. But for the most part, they were theorists who worried about the kind of structure of the equations and what it might mean about the universe. And so their thoughts were going more to the, we might say, ethereal realm, you know.
Well, I have a question here. Now, you know, we're talking about their influence and possible developments that have been inspired by these guys. And you mentioned that the perhaps the premier quantum mechanics researcher is Anton Zeilinger, who's an Austrian physicist. To what extent do you think modern cutting-edge physicists were influenced by these guys? And do we see some sort of influence now in the modern physics world? Did they help loosen up the field a little bit, get people thinking more creatively? Or what is their legacy really now in modern physics?
So I think in the narrow sort of tight focus, they do have a legacy in these very specific results that I mentioned before, like the no cloning theorem, no signaling, and quantum limits to amplifiers. And those are technical developments that really are kind of bedrock for a whole flourishing field today. And again, it's not that the folks I read about uniquely found those things, but they really had a major hand in pushing that whole program forward, and often, you know, designing the devices in the debunking of which, you know, these insights would appear. So they were clearly there. And those, I think, are, you know, they're incredibly important developments that we just didn't know about before these folks got in the game. And then if we zoom out a little bit, you know, these folks were the early adopters on Bell's theorem more broadly. I mean, they were the ones who said long before this was at all common for physicists to even pay any attention to, that quantum entanglement is baffling and probably really, really important. They, as I write in the book, they rescued that topic from a decade of obscurity. They forced it onto the agenda for at least a few other physicists in addition to their own. And so they helped kind of get it back into the mainstream or get a few people really excited about it. And then if we zoom out further, you know, they wrote those books, like I mentioned. They really inspired a whole genre of popular physics writing and getting a lot of this stuff out into the public, some of which, in fact, this really surprised me, actually, some of which got used in formal physics classes in the classroom as a kind of proxy textbook before the regular old textbooks caught up with the new stuff about quantum theory like Bell's theorem. Books like the ones we mentioned written by these folks, or formal lesson plans that were published inspired by those books, you know, by physicists who were talking with them pretty regularly, you know, they had a kind of a direct pedagogical impact in the classroom that was important in the era before these sort of slow-moving textbooks could catch up. So we can sort of zoom out from a tight focus to get broader and broader. And again, it's not like these folks single-handedly changed the world. I don't think any small group ever does. But they were really having an impact. They have a legacy that if we know where to look for it, we can start seeing some of that signs of it even today.
Now, one of the topics often discussed when we talk about the word quantum is quantum computing. Now, is this such a thing possible? We're all living in the world of ones and zeros, the digital world. Is this really the next stage of computing?
I have a feeling it really is. It's not the area of physics that I work in directly. I have a number of colleagues who do. They're really smart, and they make a good case. And I think there is some. I mean, there are working prototypes of sort of low capacity compared to anyone's laptop on their desktop right now on their desk. But these things are taking advantage of this fundamental quantum property, things like superposition or indeed entanglement and Bell's theorem, that are being, you know, literally wired in from the start. And these folks can keep these things, you know, they have to put them in cryogenic coolers, they have to treat them with great nimbleness so far. But nonetheless, they've built a few of these things as well as worked out incredibly complicated and sophisticated, you know, theoretical descriptions.
It's not something that I can buy at the Apple store next year.
Not yet. No, it's not going to be in the iPhone 5.
Are these things practical? Do we see that 5-10 years from now, if we can figure how to get a handle on it and we don't have to live in cryogenic laboratories and stuff, that we can take this stuff and actually use it in products for space exploration and then ultimately the consumer world?
Yeah, that's definitely the intention. And so, again, I'm not an expert on the nitty-gritty of it these days, but I know that's certainly what's driving a lot of this excitement. Whether it's going to be 10 years from now or 20 or 50, I think it's certainly, you know, odds are good it's going to be coming.
Well, what direction is quantum physics going in right now? What are the exciting papers that are being published, and what's the buzz going around the field right now?
I think there's a lot. I mean, by now, quantum physics is central to virtually everything that physicists want to work on. So there are different aspects of quantum theory, or it shows up as relevant in different ways. So whether it's nanotechnology, which is basically pushing single atoms around, that's clearly deeply involved in quantum theory, which was the subject for which quantum theory was first designed, for understanding single atoms or just a small number of atoms. So the entire, humongous elephant in the room of nanotech is basically putting quantum theory to work in one way. And you can go from there all the way to the opposite scale and look at quantum cosmology, closer to an area I actually work in physics. The excitement about string theory or trying to quantize general relativity, the excitement about the universe, the multiverse, are we one bubble among an infinitude? Those are all making, taking advantage of weird properties of quantum theory sort of in a different direction. So I think pretty much anywhere you look these days, quantum theory is going to be incredibly central, and its sort of inherent wackiness is coming to light.
Well, we know in ufology, for instance, we do cover that subject quite extensively on our show. One of the things that you occasionally will hear is someone that does not buy in lock, stock, and barrel into an extraterrestrial hypothesis for, what's behind the UFO phenomenon. And you hear buzzwords like that they're multidimensional. Is, based on our knowledge right now, which is probably in a dimensional sense pretty limited, but do you think that there's a possibility that we may be visited by the denizens of some other dimension? Is that a possibility, you as a scientist?
I wouldn't discount it as a possibility. I also wouldn't rate it as a very high possibility, but that's just could very well be my own limited imagination or knowledge. So we could unpack that. Think about doing like a Drake equation for the version you just described. What's the likelihood that the universe that we live in has extra spatial dimensions? The likelihood of that is actually, I would say, higher, better reasons to believe that now than even 20 or 30 years ago. So that's a pretty big change, or at least better reasons to worry about it, to think about it. It has very specific motivations that put it on the table now. And so if that increases the overall likelihood for the rest of your scenario, that's sort of how the science has to, it seems to me, would go along. And more importantly, if there are ways to get experimental observational input on are there extra dimensions, how are they characterized, and people are hoping they might catch some glimpse, the long shot, maybe catch a glimpse of something like that in the Large Hadron Collider that's now spinning up in CERN, or maybe by a different sort of mechanism might affect the very subtle bumps and wiggles in the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's a kind of cutting-edge research question to, are there extra dimensions, and if so, how do we understand them? What else might they imply? What do they open up?
No, do you think that this is one of the more exciting periods?
Dimensionally speaking, we have David Kaiser. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Ray Perkins, a reclusive veteran burned out from the Gulf War, lives tortured by relentless, perplexing nightmares. Nightmares of a horrific battle in deep space and of a mysterious woman suffering in agony for her devastated world. A woman not yet born, calling across centuries to him. Then, a coincidence leads him to his destiny, his chance to alter the universe. Attack of the Rockaways. The former fiction editor for Star Wars and Indiana Jones, Robert Simpson, writes, "The soul of the novel Attack of the Rockaways lies in its heart and passion for building a convincing tale of a love that spans the galaxy. A thrilling story. Attack of the Rockaways is available now. Read a sample chapter and get a special discount off of the cover price at our website, rockoids.com. That's rockoids.com. Attack of the Rockaways, a novel in the grand science fiction tradition."
Hey Brian, if you could do just one thing today to ensure your family's food security, what would it be?
That's easy, Bill. I'd head straight to soupbeansurvival.com.
Soupbeansurvival.com?
I know, Bill, it sounds crazy, but this ancient secret has been around for over 8,000 years, and it truly is nature's super survival food.
Really, Brian, the number one survival food? Well, certainly the forgotten survival food.
Absolutely, Bill. The folks at soupbeansurvival.com scoured our planet to find the very best heirloom seeds, to truly find nature's super survival food.
Brian, these aren't grocery store beans, are they?
No way, Bill. You're not going to find these beans in any grocery store. These are the absolute highest quality beans in the world. Visit soupbeansurvival.com. That's soupbeansurvival.com for all the information you're going to need for nature's super survival food.
Big Berkey water filters are in high demand. Storable foods are also in high demand. BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com has always kept our focus on the Berkey water filter products, but increasingly, our customers have been asking for storable foods. After months of research, BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com now offers great-tasting, long-lasting, storable foods. These ready-to-eat meals are packed in airtight nitrogen pouches. All you do is just add water, and because they're sealed so well, they come with a 25-year shelf life. Combine our Berkey water filters, which are powerful enough to purify treated, untreated, or even stagnant pond water with our storable foods, and you have a winning combination. Remember, we offer free shipping on every order over $50, and GCN listeners receive 5% off all ceramic filter systems. Visit BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY. That's BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY today.
You know that drinking pure, high-alkaline water is one of the most important factors in maintaining high energy and vibrant health, and most experts agree that the water you drink should be at a pH level of 8 or higher. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops, available only at AlkaVision.com, combine a unique formula of most alkaline minerals available. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops alkalize your water, ridding the body of harmful toxins and acid, helping you to regain your energy and health. Alkalizing your water by simply adding 10 drops of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops helps the body to rid itself of acidic waste, increases oxygen, and raises the pH of your body to optimal levels. And bacteria and viruses cannot survive in an alkaline high pH environment. Order your bottle of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops for only $29.95 at AlkaVision.com. That's AlkaVision.com. Or call 269-409-1776. 269-409-1776. Alkalize your body. Supercharge your health at AlkaVision.com.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hi, this is Don Ecker, and you are tuned into the Paracast. Let me tell you what, you're going to hear stuff here that you probably won't hear anywhere else. Hear that, George Snorri?
We're back with David Kaiser talking about, I guess, cutting-edge physics, quantum mechanics, all that stuff, that way out there stuff. With David Kaiser, I'm Gene Steinberg. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. Chris, before we did our break, you had started a question.
Well, I've just been seeing so much in the news lately, spokespeople like Michio Kaku is such a good writer, And there are other writers that, similar to the books in the early 70s that came out. In fact, that's where I first learned about quantum physics. It was in the Tao of Physics and the Dancing Wu Li Masters. There were several other books as well. People like Michio Kaku now, I think, are they're so accessible, and they're elegantly able to relay such mind-boggling information to lay people. I get a sense that quantum physics is in a real up period right now. How would you rate this time period now in terms of excitement in the field?
I definitely agree. I mean, I agree both about the talented writers now, like Michio Kaku, like Brian Greene, in fact, like lots of people. I think they are really good at that. And even when they're not trying to necessarily write engaging books for non-specialists, you know, in their own offices, I think you're right, it is an exciting time. You know, one of my colleagues at MIT is Max Tegmark, and he'd share that sort of wild, giddy enthusiasm, or Seth Lloyd, or all these folks. And I think it's partly for the reason I said before. I mean, when we go to the hyper-small to the mind-bogglingly large, in each direction we're getting sort of new insights into quantum theory. It's leading to new questions and often to some really very fancy new experiments as well. So the subtitle for my book was The Quantum Revival. And I think that was really meant to say there's an exciting thing going on now, and I think a lot of physicists will feel that.
Let me ask you a question that kind of arises from that. We're looking at all this cutting-edge science. How does organized religion handle all these developments, or can they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, it's not the area of my expertise. I think there might be different responses from different, traditions or religious communities. One thing I will say is I take us off track. One thing that was interesting to me was seeing the rise of a kind of anti-Big Bang fervor from some corners of a kind of creationist or intelligent design science. So some folks seemed not very comfortable or very happy with the picture we have of a Big Bang, inflationary cosmology, the sort of mainstream view of how the universe began. And so some of the folks who would otherwise be spending a lot of time critiquing, Darwinian natural selection in biology classrooms, some of them have turned their sights onto the Big Bang. So that's one example. It's certainly not the only example of, kind of religion or spirituality encountering these questions. Just to say that it's going to be a mixed bag, and I don't know, who's giving the most serious thought to that. I haven't been. It's not where I would really be an expert.
Was the impact to religion anything that they thought about when all those hippie scientists were getting together all those years ago?
I see. Well, some more than others. So people like Fritjof Capra, I think, were really earnestly, genuinely interested in sort of the Eastern worldview, a very religious, spiritual worldview, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and that whole Taoism and all the rest. And so Fritjof became a kind of devoted student of that. He was reading everything he could. He'd go to all the seminars in the Bay Area he could, and even when he left the Bay Area. So for some people, yes, I think religion or at least some kind of spirituality was absolutely central to that ongoing evolving set of questions. I'm not sure it played the same role or had the same impact even for all members just of that tiny group, let alone for other folks, at the time. So for some of them, yeah, you can definitely see that was an important feature.
Okay, so looking further at the impact, what about the fact that our space program has been cut down in a large way, especially at the end of the shuttle program? Does that hurt this kind of research?
I don't know if it'll hurt in a direct way. I think it might hurt more in the sense of who's asking the big, weird, out there questions and who's going to be inspired by amazing things. I don't think there was much of a budget spillover, at least none that I know of. In other words, I don't think we cash it out nickels and dimes from one appropriation line to another. But I think, the larger question of what's our place in the universe, what does it all mean, I think a lot of people for decades have found, deep, deep inspiration from the space program. And so we want to look at those, we might say, second order effects, where there we might indeed see an impact.
Now, what is your personal opinion about this? Do you think they went about it all wrong in cutting back on the space program? You kind of think that the promise that was realized with the moon landing in 1969, it was never really followed up in a huge way.
It's a tough one. As a kid, I was completely enamored of the space program. My walls were covered. My friends would have had, like rock star posters up, and I would have had, astronaut and space shuttle posters up. So, I grew up with that stuff. I built model rockets, and I'm going to try to get my kids into that now. And so, I was definitely a kind of space junkie. And so it is pretty sad for me just personally to realize that, the last shuttle launch has now passed and so on. On the other hand, who knows, maybe some other, exciting, cool thing will start to take its place. And so, when I put my historian's cap back on, even at the height of the Apollo program, there was a lot of concern in this country about budget priorities, not unlike today. Cities were crumbling, horrible, challenges. And a lot of critics, even back then, said, there has to be some kind of cost-benefit trade-off. And I can at least sympathize with those concerns. There's a limit to what we can try to do. We hear about these limits all the time these days, financially, economic in this country. So it's tricky. I mean, what do we do to accomplish great things, to inspire just absolute, euphoria in people, which I think is incredibly important for asking big questions, keeping people excited. But, we don't have unlimited resources. So, that's your wishy-washy answer to say, I wish we could do more. I can understand why there are limits.
Another question here is, Can we relate any of this research to the sources for new forms of energy? Running out of oil, high price of oil, looking at all the alternatives, electric cars, whatever. Is there anything in physics that we could look to, maybe an unlimited source of energy, free energy, whatever?
Well, you know, so that's an idea where it does get kicked around, I would say, sort of on the margins still. I'm not convinced of that. I'm not going to say that's definitely right or wrong, but it's, I think most mainstream physicists are not, you know, convinced by that. But again, that doesn't mean people shouldn't necessarily, you know, keep pushing on it. So people often will, there are all kinds of, you know, terms and jargon that will get, you know, passed around in that. And again, I'll just say that I haven't seen enough yet to be convinced, but that could be my fault and not the fault of the folks, you know, who are working on it.
Now, looking at the crazy quilt stuff that we deal with on the PowerCast, obviously you covered some of that with the investigations at universities of people who claim to have various extrasensory powers. Now, if E.T. is out there 50 light years from here, does he or she or it have to spend 50 years getting here? How do they come here, or do you think they have come here?
Well, that's a great question. So the first response would be to say they would probably take a lot more than 50 years because they probably couldn't travel even close to the actual speed of light. So if they're 50 light years away, it would take 50 years if they were, because as you know, if they're traveling at the speed of light, if we believe Einstein's relativity, they couldn't even get that speed. So, okay, so we're looking at, you know, decades. And then on the other hand, you know, you can ask about, you know, space-time is really a pretty weird, fun thing to think about. And so if you take Einstein's general relativity seriously, you know, could there be wormholes? Could there be non-trivial structures? Could there be topologies in space and time that we just aren't aware of yet that could be like the ultimate shortcut? And, you know, lots of people, lots of straight-laced university professors have thought about that very hard, let alone other folks who find it inspiring and wacky and who might be more on the margins. So, again, I wouldn't say no, it could never, ever, ever be shown because, you know, look, people like Stephen Hawking worry about closed time-like paths. People like Kip Thorne at Caltech have done incredibly sophisticated studies of exotic structures in Einstein's relativity and wormholes and all the rest. So, you know, I'd say that's a fair question, and one that even if the answer ultimately still turns out to be no, we're going to learn a lot in the process.
We have David Kaiser learning a lot in the process. This is your science school where we're trying to look at cutting-edge science in a way that we can all relate to it. We have a co-host, Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Graphic Converter is the image manipulation tool for the rest of us. It does not use any database. You get full control of all your files. Want to view the images of a folder? Drag it into Graphic Converter, and a powerful browser opens up to show your image files. You could use it for slideshows. You could use it to import images from digital cameras or from scanners. Need to do some image editing? You can do that too in Graphic Converter. Also, print catalogs. Convert from so many formats, I can't even list them. Download now to see if Graphic Converter is good for you, like 1.5 million other users. Guess what? You could save money when you buy Graphic Converter. Use the coupon code NIGHTOWL. Use the coupon code NIGHTOWL to get a special price for Graphic Converter. Go to LemkeSoft.com. That's LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com.
If you owe the IRS money you can't pay, then listen carefully, because you already know that the problem won't go away by itself. You can get help today from the leading tax expert in the country, Dan Pilla.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. The IRS isn't going to just forget about you. Right now, the IRS is hiring thousands of tax collectors to go after delinquent accounts just like yours. That's why you need to take action today, and I can help. I take a simple but proven approach to solving your tax debt problem. First, I stabilize collections so you don't have to worry about wage and bank levies. Next, I build a detailed plan to get your debt reduced to the fullest extent possible, sometimes even eliminated. Finally, I work with you every step of the way to get your problem solved once and for all. So call now for a free consultation. Call 1-800-346-6829.
Dan Pilla will solve your tax problem, guaranteed. He's helped thousands of people, and he can help you too.
Call us today at 800-346-6829. That's 800-34-NO-TAX.
If you drive for a living, you don't get paid to stop or wait in line. Keep your wheels moving with PrePass. Bypass way stations. Fly by port of entry facilities. Stay moving at highway speed while the guy without PrePass waits in line. Save time, save money. Call 888-401-PASS to try PrePass free. That's 888-401-PASS.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
Heart and Body Extract continues to receive positive testimonials from people who have experienced amazing results, like Reed.
I just wanted to send you a quick but a very big thank you for Heart and Body Extract. I've been on the formula for nearly a month now, and the improvement in the circulation of my leg has been simply amazing.
Reed was facing a tough choice.
I was facing surgery due to the severity of the 100% blocked arteries in both my legs. And my decision, waiting for surgery, to say no and try Heart and Body Extract instead has been thankfully the right decision.
And the result?
I can now walk up steps without noticeable pain.
Order Heart and Body Extract at 866-295-5305, 866-295-5305, or hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, for a long and healthy life.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hi, this is nuclear physicist lecturer Stanton Friedman. You are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We continue with David Kaiser discussing cutting-edge science with Gene and Chris on the Paracast. We're trying to keep up with him, okay? Because I didn't go to MIT. I didn't pretend to go at MIT. I've read the science literature, but, you know, we're trying to keep it at a sensible level. Okay, David Kaiser, the other question is, we're involved in all these things that impact space and time. So, can we travel to the future? Can we travel to the past? Can we take that quantum leap, as they say on the TV show?
Well, you know, look, we can certainly travel to the future, which is just by sitting still and letting the clock tick by. Could we make a great leap toward the future? Then it gets more tricky, and likewise for the past. So, again, I'd say the mainstream consensus seems to be no, or at least not yet. And yet, you know, relativity continues to surprise us. And so I wouldn't want to say never, ever, never under those circumstances. I'd say I haven't seen it yet. And that, again, could just as much be my own limited imagination. But, you know, general relativity, even canonical, even just Einstein's version of relativity, has all kinds of amazing features. And there's a flourishing kind of industry of scientists working on extensions beyond Einstein's relativity, where even more sort of exotic or unexpected things could be possible, at least in theory. So I haven't seen the great proof yet, but very smart and earnest people are working on it all the time. At least I'm trying to understand that on a theoretical level, even if maybe not building, you know, their own time machines just yet.
We were talking about some of the current buzzwords and aspects of quantum physics that are now currently being bantered about. Back in the early 90s, I seem to recall there was a bit of a flurry of interest in cold fusion. I haven't heard anything about that recently. Is this a dead area of inquiry or study, or where are we in that process?
Well, again, you know, I'm no expert in what's going on most recently. I do know it's not dead in the sense that there are still people working on, in fact, is a sociologist of science who coined it the undead science. It's like a zombie that that actually won't seems not to die. And some people, at least, are, yeah, I thought that was a good description. And again, I'm not going to cast aspersions on those who are doing it now. I'm not following it. I do know there, you know, the numbers following it now, I think, have dwindled even from the heyday that you described. But it's not zero. And so, you know, some people are convinced there's still something there.
How about building machines based on dark matter? I've been seeing something lately that there's some question of whether dark matter is even real. Obviously, theoretically, you know, I know Hal Puthoff was very interested in it. I know Sarfati's been very interested in it and others. But what is this current, this new development in there where now the whole concept is being questioned?
Well, so I'm not sure the specifics that you're referring to. I do know in general, there have been a lot of efforts. You know, dark matter is so troubling, right, to most astrophysicists, because it's like, who ordered that? We don't want that stuff, right? It means that, again, as I'm sure you listeners know, means that on the order of a quarter, about roughly 25% of the energy balance of the entire universe is stuff that we don't have any idea what it is, and we've never detected it, we can't smell it, we can't catch it in our laboratory, at least we haven't yet, despite some very good tries. And we have no clear idea of what it might be, lots of competing hypotheses. And so it would be great if there were no need for dark matter at all, which is one grand mistake. But that's pretty hard, too. I mean, again, I won't discount every effort, but we think we understand Einstein's relativity really, really well, from lots of angles, with lots of sensitive tests. And if Einstein's relativity is to hold, then it seems, to my understanding, we really do need this mysterious missing matter, this dark matter, to make sense of the behavior of galaxies, the way they rotate, the way they behave gravitationally. And so it could be that Einstein's relativity is just wrong, and there's some other theory we don't know yet. That's always possible, right? And maybe that would get away from the need for dark matter, if the gravitational interaction itself would give the same result without this mysterious stuff. But that's, I think that would be fairly called a long shot. Not impossible, but a long shot. And if galaxies are behaving the way we think they are, the way we think we understand they should, then I think we're largely stuck with this missing, you know, this mystery of what is this stuff. And so before we can build machines out of it, let's detect some first. Let's catch them
really?
In the lab. Yeah.
And then you can play with it. First, you got to prove, you know, kind of figure out what exactly it is. That's a heck of a lot of. I mean, the universe is pretty big place, and 25% of it just still being an unknown is that must perplex a lot of people. Here's another one. Now, Andrew kind of mentioned this one to me before. He was wondering if the Higgs boson particle is not found at the Large Hadron Collider. What happens to the standard model?
Define that for our listeners, because their eyes are just glazed over.
Yeah. Fair enough. So a couple things there. The Higgs boson, I guess some of your listeners might know, it's often in the news these days. It's so far, still hypothetical particle. No one's had definitive, you know, observational measurements of it yet, despite lots of trying, still trying now. So it's a hypothetical particle that really is central to our understanding of the basic forces between parts of atoms, between subatomic particles. It's one of the main mechanisms that actually gives rise to mass, as to why do we see an electron has a certain mass instead of having no mass at all. And so it seems to literally hold the whole picture together. It's the only particle from that entire what's called the standard model, from our understanding of the basic forces of nature, that has never been seen. Every other piece of that standard model by now has been seen. We can, you know, capture them in our labs. We can mess around with them, measure them carefully, build stuff out of them in many cases. And the one missing component, the one piece that we just have never, ever seen directly is this Higgs particle. So if it is not there at all, then you can play the usual game, saying, well, it must be in some different, you know, must have a different mass than we thought, it must lie outside the range, we need a bigger atom smasher. But you can only do that so far, because then other things start becoming, you know, inconsistent. And so you can't play the game too much more. Otherwise, you could say maybe there just is no Higgs particle, and it's kind of back to the drawing board in that case. So that's both exciting, because we'll have lots more to do and apply for, you know, for grants, but it's, that would be that would be a real big, I think the word shock would not be inappropriate. That would be a big, big deal if they're just honestly no Higgs. We've been thinking about this thing and drawing conclusions about what properties it must have since the early 60s. And if it really isn't there 50 years later, you know, that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal, yeah. Well, you know, I've been reading some rather alarmist blogs and articles about people really being in a place of fear about what's going on at CERN. And, you know, you hear things bannered about like, oh, they're going to create a wormhole or they're going to create something that's going to eat the Earth. And, you know, there's a lot of alarmism out there. And do you think that kind of thinking somehow relates to the fact that science has leapt ahead so far away from the common, you know, your average Joe out there? Joe Sixpack is sitting there, you know, watching the news. And do you think that there's a really increasing gap between the ivory towers of science and the average person? And do you think that this somehow can relate to what appears to be a real upsurge in interest in the last couple of decades in areas of in subjects that most scientists just roll their eyes, whether it's you know, all these ghost shows and UFO shows and this interest in more magical mystical things? Do you think that that's a direct result of this increasing gap between cutting edge science, quantum theory, and just these wonderful you know, leaps ahead that we're doing in terms of our scientific knowledge? Do you think that there's a relation there?
You know, it's interesting. I bet there is. I bet there's other things going on, you know, in the mix as well. But I wouldn't discount it. I think you're right. And I certainly agree that this sort of increasing gap between what sort of most people can be expected to know or understand about science and the kind of cutting edge, I think that gap is getting pretty wide. And I think there's also, you know, there's since the, you know, the kind of late 60s, or certainly say the Watergate era, you know, in this country, there's been a lot less inclination to just believe what the experts are telling you, no matter who the experts are. And so I think there's a change in a kind of political culture or maybe a media culture. So it's not only we don't understand that stuff, but, you know, who are you to tell me what I shouldn't even worry about? And I, you know, I can understand that has something behind it. You know, just having fancy letters after your name doesn't mean you know everything. And we've been surprised all the time before. So there can be a kind of concern. You know, are the experts not telling us stuff? That might not be a real cause for concern. There might not be vast conspiracies of evil scientists behind the curtain, but I can understand why people might be worried. You know, do we know everything we need to know? They tell me not to worry, but we've heard that before.
I'll tell you what, we have to do this break. We have David Kaiser. The book is called How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Hi, Ted Anderson announcing a great way to listen to radio on the telephone. By calling 760-569-7700, you'll be hearing GCNLive.com programs in seconds. Come to GCNLive.com, find your favorite host's dedicated phone number, and hear them 24/7. You heard me right. Every show has a dedicated phone number. Stop by GCNLive.com and bookmark their number today. And again, that's 760-569-7700. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.